Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. I don't even have a whole list of all the places. You know, if you're smart enough to be listening, you can probably figure how to subscribe to this podcast. We're joined today by Ian Basson, who is the executive director of Protect Democracy. First of all, hey, thanks for joining me, and I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
We've had this conversation across the political divide before, and I've argued, and I'm willing to be refuted on it, that you know, right now in America, there's not a, if you had a big Venn diagram, not the kind of Venn diagram that Scott Walker makes, but an actual real Venn diagram between right and left, there's not a lot of overlap, but the area where there is an overlap is really important, and it is things like protecting democracy, rule of law, things like that. And I do think that there is some, you know, element for common ground on a lot of this. And I think you agree with me on that.
Look, I have to pinch myself sometimes, Charlie, that you and I are, you know, collaborators in trying to save the foundations of kind of our system of government here, because I think if you flashed back 5-10 years, you and I would be arguing vigorously about the many ways in which we disagree on policy matters. And hopefully, flash forward 5-10 years, we'll be doing that again.
I think that's very likely.
But right now, the problem is the way that we're able to do that, where you and I can argue about what the top marginal tax rate should be, is in danger, because the way that we resolve those deliberations and debates in a healthy democracy is we have a system of checks and balances and votes and elections and rule of law, and that stuff's under strain, and we all have to come together to protect it so that we can argue about policy again in a peaceful way.
Okay, so what protect democracy. What are you most worried about? I mean, obviously, first of all, people listening to this podcast go, we're not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic, and I don't think you disagree with this, but what is it that keeps you up at night? What are you most concerned about when we talk about this? Because there are folks who will say, look, you know, after 2 years of Trump, what we found out is that our system is actually pretty resilient. The checks and balances seem to be working. The institutions seem to be holding up. We actually do have elections that have consequences. So what is it that you are most anxious about or fearful about?
1995, a survey found that 1 in 16 Americans said they would be comfortable with a form of military rule in the United States. A couple of years ago, that same survey revealed the number to be 1 in 6. That entire shift is young people. So someone that you and I both know, Yasha Monk, did a study recently where he found that among older Americans, people over 70, 75% think democracy is a necessary form of government. Among younger Americans, it's only about 30%. Now, again, yes, we're not a democracy, a straight democracy, right? Our founders combined democratic principles and republican principles to create a democratic republic. But the notion that not just in the United States, but around the world, the concepts underpinning liberal democracy are in retreat. Look at Brazil, Turkey, Hungary, Poland. Donald Trump is just a symptom of a global trend against democracy. So what keeps me up at night is, will we come out differently than Brazil or Turkey? Or will we not?
Well, see, this is the question that I think always haunts us, that up until very recently, I think Americans had been very, very complacent about all of this. I think that we had believed that these institutions, things like, you know, democratic constitutional republics were, you know, had been resolved. They were a consensus. And I think one of the things we found out is that they are much more fragile, that America is not, in fact, immune to history, and that, you know, it's naive to sit back and go, well, yeah, that happens over there. You know, authoritarianism, that happens over there. But we Americans, we are special. So Donald Trump, if Donald Trump is in fact a symptom, how did we get this? How did we get here? What is causing young people or people across the political spectrum to say that they no longer have confidence in a democratic republic? Is there anything you can put your finger on? Is it just cynicism? Is it the failures of our system?
I think one of the things that caused this was we're a victim a little bit of our own success in a way, which is that I often like to think about if you go to some less stable countries, particularly places in, say, Central America, everybody's plugged into politics, right? The political shows are in every cafe and people are talking about it all the time. And it's because the fragility and the stability of the systems in those countries was so volatile that people had to pay attention because so much directly impacted their lives. And I think for many Americans, not all, but for many Americans, the boom of the 20th century, the Pax Americana, gave us the luxury of not having to care as much, not having to invest as much. And I think that that luxury led to a lack of investment in our institutions that allowed them to decay and erode. And I think if you grew up in the most recent generation and you came of age post 1995 and the falling of the towers was one of your formative memories, the dysfunction, the gridlock in Washington is what you saw. The fact that we almost defaulted on our debt ceiling for no reason other than our own incompetence. What is giving you confidence in a system that looks like that? There's reason to question it. And until we get to a place where the system is delivering results for all Americans again, I think we're going to be fighting this perception that, is this the best system?
Well, I've argued that we have a crisis of citizenship. We can look at the leaders, we can look at the media, we can look at a lot of other folks, but we have an erosion of this sense of the responsibility of citizens. What role did our educational system play in all of this? The lack of civics education, the historical ignorance. I mean, I do think we are a culture that suffers from historical amnesia. Does that concern you? Because I will tell you, the number of conversations I've had about the rule of law or talk about the constitutional structure, and I can see in the eyes of the person that I'm talking to that this is just not registering, that a lot of the basic fundamental historical analogies, constitutional structures that we might have taken for granted, they don't know. Do they not know it because they were not taught it? Do we dumb ourselves down?
I think probably there has been some erosion in civics education, but I don't want to put the blame. I don't want to claim that there is an ignorance that's causing this among young people. I think young people are being quite rational. If you grew up through the boom post-war years in the United States, especially if you were white, you were pretty much guaranteed to do better than your parents did. There was, at least relatively for most people in the United States, again, there were isolated pockets of the population from this wasn't true. You were guaranteed peace and security, large pockets of the population from that wasn't true. It's rational that in that situation, you would say, hey, this system's working pretty well. If you grew up, in more recent years where, if you're lucky enough to go to college, you're going to be saddled with massive amounts of student debt. You're watching videos of heads being cut off on YouTube. You see dysfunction in Washington. You're probably not going to do better than your parents did. It's pretty rational to say, hey, maybe this system's not working. You look at the growth of China. You look at least in some recent years, sort of the growth in Turkey, GDP growth in Turkey. You say, well, those systems are doing pretty well, and they're run by more autocratic forms of government. Maybe Churchill was wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's so much ignorance as a pretty rational response to developments.
Well, and there's also I know the term is now overused, but the tribalism of our politics, where we demonize the people on the other side to the extent that we're just simply not willing to accept the legitimacy of their successes, by which, democracy really does rely upon the sense that, okay, we may differ about the issues, but I will acquiesce to you winning an election. I'm not going to question the legitimacy of you being in power. But if you have a culture in which you really do think that the other side is morally depraved or, hates America and hates God, then it's going to be less likely that you're going to be willing to engage in the restraint of a citizen in a democratic republic.
I think one of the things this conversation is illuminating is that it's hard to pinpoint one factor,
right,
that is sort of driving the crisis that we're facing. I think it is an aggregate. It's almost as if the ship of state has sailed into a perfect storm, in which you have changing labor market demographics, automation, probably more automation than globalization, that is causing strains in the labor force and causing people to wonder, what kind of jobs are my children going to have?
Right, right.
You have geographic sorting, where you've got sort of, by, again, to your tribalism point, people who tend to agree geographically organizing themselves. The gerrymandering problem has exacerbated what that does to the ability of people to bargain and negotiate and compromise in Congress. And the other thing I would say is driving this, in addition to loss of faith in democratic institutions, is it is striking if you read histories of the post-Reconstruction period in the reaction to the elevation of, at that time, African Americans into elected office, and how those who were not comfortable with it reacted against that, and seeing some of those parallels in reaction to the election of Barack Obama. The parallels are quite striking. If you look at things like the slaughterhouse cases in 1875, peeling back the slaughterhouse cases, which peeled back the Civil Rights Act of 1875, has a lot of parallels to the Shelby County decision striking down parts of the Voting Rights Act, where essentially John Roberts in this case, and in the latter part of the 19th century, the Supreme Court then said, things are getting better. We don't need these statutes anymore. And of course, the elimination of them made things not get better anymore. So I think it's all these factors coming together that are causing a situation in which our democratic institutions are under strain.
Yeah, let's fast forward to where we're at right now. And of course, I always look for people who are more optimistic than I am, because I do think that there are two different models when you look at American politics. There's the pendulum model that, you know, yes, it goes one way and it goes, you know, will come back the other way, you know, after you know, George Bush, you have Barack Obama, you know, after Jimmy Carter, you have Ronald Reagan, and things are sort of self-correcting. The other model, which I'm afraid that I often buy into, is the ratchet model, that every time there's damage, every time you move something down, every time a norm is eroded, that it's really hard to restore that, and so that, you know, things get better. The other argument that we hear from people is like, don't worry about these democratic norms because there is this incredible resilience. And I want to believe that, but I will say, and I want to see what you think about this. The things that worry me the most are things like the rule of law, the fact that we're actually having an argument about whether the president can pardon himself and his own cronies, whether the president of the United States is capable of obstructing justice. When you have somebody like a Matthew Whitaker go in as the acting attorney general, when you see the almost, and you and I may have a slight disagreement about this, but the almost unlimited power the president has to pardon people. And the question about, you know, will we in fact find out what happened with the president in Russia, you know, or will the attorney general, you know, find an excuse not to do it? So where do you come down on all of this, the institutional resilience? What are the most vulnerable parts that you would worry about?
I think of us as essentially all gathered together in a wooden house somewhere on the Great Plains as a tornado is hammering the walls of the house. And the walls are shaking and the windows are rattling, but it's holding, right? And this is the optimism point, right? We look around, we say, you know, the system's holding. It's pretty resilient.
Yeah, but I've seen this movie, and it's The Wizard of Oz.
Yes, you know, and that's the point. Is that if you're sitting in that rocking chair, right, with the fire going and your pipe and your paper next to you, and that's happening, you don't just keep rocking, right? You go get the duct tape, you go get the sandbags, you go reinforce the windows, right? And I think it's a way of understanding that you can both think that the system is holding and that it's resilient, and yet there's still work to be done. Right. You have to. You would be silly to sit there and not go get the sandbags because you've seen The Wizard of Oz. Right. And so I think we're in a situation where, to your question, OK, so I look around that house. Where do I want to put the sandbags? Where do I want to put the duct tape? Where do I want to hammer some wood boards? And you hit on a couple of it. Right. The independence of the Department of Justice. How do we reinforce that? How do we ensure that the president is not above the law? And I just want to allude to a few examples of things that we're doing at Protect Democracy. So, for example, we've intervened in two cases, filed papers in two cases in New York State Court, where the president's lawyers have claimed that the president is immune from civil suit, that he's above the law for civil suits charging him with misconduct for private activity.
And I thought that had been resolved in the Clinton case.
You would think, right? 9-0 in the Paula Jones Clinton case in the Supreme Court. Well, the president's lawyers have said, aha, wait. But there's a footnote in that case that says that case only applies to federal court, and these lawsuits are in state court. So this is the Summer Zervos, the Apprentice contestant sexual harassment lawsuit, and the New York Attorney General lawsuit against the Trump Foundation. And in both those cases, the president's lawyers have said, no, this is state court. It's different than Clinton v. Jones. Now, thankfully, in both cases, the New York courts have said absolutely not, and have adopted the argument that we've put forward. And by the way, in those cases, cases, we represent three legal scholars who filed the same essential briefs and arguments in the Clinton case to make the point that it doesn't matter the party of the president. In our country, the president is not above the law. I'll give one other example. We recently, through a lawsuit, forced the Department of Justice to admit that the report it put out linking immigrants to terrorism, which it at the direction of the president, was riddled with errors and was misleading. There's another word for that. I think you could call it propaganda, right? And that was through a lawsuit using something called the Information Quality Act to say, hey, when our government puts out statistical data and information, it has to adhere to some methodological standards to ensure accuracy, because otherwise you mislead the public in ways that are quite dangerous for self-government. So there are things that we can do as citizens, to your point, active citizens engaging to hold our government accountable, but that's the work of going to get the sandbags. We can't just sit back and expect the system to defend and protect itself.
So tell me what you thought about William Barr's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Well, I think there were aspects of it in terms of his promises to allow the special counsel investigation to conclude.
That sounded reassuring.
That sound reassuring, give one hope. At the same time, there were aspects of where he very deliberately, and I've helped prepare people. I used to be a White House counsel, an associate White House counsel. I helped prepare people for Hill testimony. And you could tell he had crafted some answers to give himself a lot of wiggle room on things like, for example, would the final Mueller report be made public? And
yeah.
If you parse his answers to that, he leaves himself a lot of outs. I think extracting out from the hearings, though, look, having coached people on these hearings, you can navigate a hearing pretty deftly if you're careful about what you say. The question is, what is one's philosophy? And I think Charlie Savage has had some good pieces in the New York Times recently on Barr's history of his legal philosophy and his legal philosophy about quite broad executive powers. Looked like it would have worked really well, and I think did work pretty well, when you had a president like George H.W. Bush, who himself was quite restrained and, to use a Bushism, prudent,
right,
about how to exercise his powers. When you combine that very extreme view of executive power that Barr has held his entire career with a president who is, I think it would be an understatement to say, imprudent and unrestrained about executive power, that's a pretty toxic mix.
That's
a pretty dangerous mix.
You've made a really interesting point here, because I think that prudence is an underappreciated conservative value, and it's one that would hope that we'll make a comeback at some point. But yeah, it's very different being the attorney general under someone like a George H.W. Bush, who is steeped in these traditions and the restraints and the respect for the institutions of our government. Very different thing to be the attorney general for that president and for Donald Trump. So you can take the exact same person and say he was perfectly right for this moment in this particular role, and precisely not right. Now, I don't know. I don't have a vote in the Senate. The best case for confirming William Barr seems to me is getting rid of Matthew Whitaker, which was really, I think, kind of a terrifying point. But also, I think I want to get your take on this as well, because I do think that we're having this moment where we realize that putting quotes around that, you know, that we have invested the president with way too many powers, that we have made him, beyond imperial, many of us had assumed that there were norms and traditions that would restrain the president, only to find out that these norms and traditions are, in fact, not statutory. This is something that going back 5, 10 years was, or even, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, was a push and pull between the left and the right, where, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when conservatives were much more suspicious of the concentration of power in the executive. Will there be a rethinking on the progressive side of politics about the extent to which we have concentrated power in the executive as a result of what we're going through now, do you think?
Yes, and I think you're already seeing it. And to your point about how we've relied so heavily on norms. So when I was in the White House, as a lawyer in the White House, I had part of my portfolio was ensuring that executive branch officials follow the rules. And I had three binders in my office that had memos going back to the Eisenhower White House from White House counsels and chiefs of staff, explaining to White House staff what those rules were. And the thing about those memos that's so eye-opening is, as you note, a lot of those rules are not legally binding. They're simply traditional. We used to refer to those as sort of White House common law. People would come and ask the counsel's office, can I do this or how do I do that? And we'd go, well, how did they do it before? And unless there's some compelling reason to deviate, like Eisenhower didn't have Twitter, then we would stick with how they did it before. And one of the motivations for forming Protect Democracy was in part, what happens when you have a movement led by a president who doesn't just not care about those norms and traditions, but actually ran for office on a platform of we should abolish and get rid of a lot of these. Some of those are the things that separate us from far less democratic forms of government. So just one example, we used to have a host of rules that told White House staff when they could and how they could contact staff at the Department of Justice. Those are rules that basically Republican and Democratic administrations have adhered to since the post-Nixon period. What happens if these people don't care about that? I think we're witnessing that right now.
Right. This is, and I want to give credit where credit is due here. I think it was Garry Kasparov who said, what we found out is that a lot of this is based on an honor system, with the assumption that the person, the man or woman who was sitting in the Oval Office was an honorable person surrounded by honorable people. And now we're testing, you know, what happens when you don't have all of that. Of course, I also think the founders understood that men were not angels, which is why we have these sort of restrictions. But, you know, I remember one of the moments of disorientation in 2017 when the president declared, you know, these conflict of interest rules don't apply to me. I'm basically above the conflict of interest rules. And my initial reaction was, that's crazy. That's not true. But he was right. He's
yes.
right. There are ways. The president of the United States right now, with the exception of the impeachment provisions, can take members of his own personal family, his own cronies who have been engaged in criminal activities, and he can pardon them with very few checks and balances. And now we're having this discussion about whether or not the president commits obstruction of justice. If he calls in the attorney general and he says, I want you to prosecute Ian Bassin, and I want you to pardon Charlie Sykes. I want you to go after this person because, in theory, he can do this. And you know, if you buy the idea of the unitary executive, and I'm not trying to put words in William Barr's mouth, then the president, you know, not only has the power to do that, but that does not involve the obstruction of justice. That's a terrifying concept.
And I think it's one reason why I and many others don't buy the theory of the unitary executive, because it leads to a scenario that seems like it cannot be the way that we should organize our system of government. And I would question, you know, some of the things that you just assumed, that the president could, for example, pardon a family member in order to protect himself from criminal investigation. Because remember, the president put his hand on the Bible and held up his other hand and took an oath to, quote, faithfully take care of the laws be, quote, faithfully executed. Now, the founders, as we know, were very careful in their word choices and did not use extraneous words in the constitutional text. We have to assume the word faithfully means something. It means acting in good faith. And we put out a paper on the protectdemocracy.org website that goes into detail about what that actually means and imposes as a responsibility on the president in how he exercises his powers, and to say that if he were to pardon himself or a family member in order to protect himself from accountability, that is not operating in good faith. It's not faithfully. We actually did an op-ed with Paul Rosenzweig, the conservative lawyer at the R Street Institute, where we agreed on this, that there are limits to how the president can use the pardon power to protect himself, because the even more important principle in the United States is nobody, not even the president, is above the law.
Yeah, and that, by the way, is something I still think that with all the attacks on the norms, that would be an issue that I think there has to be consensus on. Okay, speaking of the lack of consensus, since we started talking about democracy, I want to talk about voting and voting rights. This, to me, is really one of the most frustrating issues, and I want to just bounce this off. How did the access to the ballot box become a partisan issue? If there's one thing that ought to unite people across the political spectrum, it is that we ought to make it as easy as possible to vote honestly, that expanding the franchise as widely as possible, that the concept of either voter fraud on the one hand or voter suppression on the other is an obscenity in a democratic system. One would think those are not controversial positions, and yet there is this bright line that seems to be getting even brighter on the question of how do we feel about voting and voting rights? So was there a turning point on all of this? Is this a gradual thing? What am I missing?
I don't think this is a new thing. I think if you go back to the founding of this country and through each of the fiery hoops that we have had to jump through to try to get to a place where we have broadened the franchise, the fights were pitted and fierce as to who we would allow to be part of the franchise. And unfortunately, if you look back historically, those fights are really rooted around identity, gender, race, age, and I suspect are a mix of both the biases that we all inherently, implicitly hold. I think as human beings, we all hold certain biases, certain anxieties about identity, and the power politics of it, because allowing new groups of people to vote and have access to the ballot means a shift in power, and typically means a shift in power away from the people who had previously held power. And as we know from history, most human beings don't give up power that easily or voluntarily. And I think we're witnessing just another iteration of that in the modern era.
Well, let me agree with you and disagree with you. Let me agree with you on this, that I was just reading a passage from the Pat Buchanan column that the president retweeted, which, by the way, I do not think has gotten enough attention. And he basically makes the point that we need to restrict immigration because we can't have these people coming in and vote, because if they will come in and vote, it will dilute the power of white men and therefore lead to Democrats winning power. I mean, it's about as naked as you could possibly get, that if we become more multicultural, more multilingual, if we have more Hispanic Americans, African Americans, women pouring into this country, terrible things will happen at the ballot box, which is, you know, certainly goes to your point. But let me give you the flip side, that there are, because I was around many of the legislators for a long time who were dealing with the question of voter integrity and were genuinely concerned, or at least I thought they were genuinely concerned, about making sure that every vote was cast and counted accurately, and there was not voter fraud. And during the initial discussions of things like voter ID, it struck most people, at least initially, in places like Wisconsin, as just simply common sense that you can't get on an airplane. You can't do a lot of things without having an ID. Make the ID as easily accessible as possible. But it was not intended, I thought, to suppress the vote as much as to assure the identity. So is there some middle ground where we can acknowledge that voter integrity and preventing fraud is a legitimate function without having it be seen as voter suppression?
Well, I think
feel free to push back on me here.
Don't worry. I will. I think the notion that we should all care about voter integrity is absolutely right and a good one. The question, as with all policies, is what are the trade-offs? And in the case of voter ID, the fact of the matter is that it does impose burdens on people who are less likely to have state-issued ID, and those tend to be people of color, young people, tend to be people who vote Democratic, and that in order to impose that burden, we would have to say that there's a compelling state interest that says that that burden somehow is outweighed by some stronger interest in protecting the integrity of the ballot. And the way I think you would find that stronger interest is by saying, well, the thing that we're worried about is actually a real danger that's really happening. But the fact of the matter is that numerous independent studies have found that voter fraud, people going in person claiming to be someone they're not in order to vote, is vanishingly non-existent. And so I don't know what happened in Wisconsin when this was being debated, but the Fourth Circuit United States Court of Appeals said that when voter ID was instituted in North Carolina, the rules that were enacted along with the voter ID, I think the line from the Fourth Circuit Court was, were drafted with almost razor-like scientific precision to impair the voting rights and access of African Americans. So I think the notion may be commonsensical that we should all be concerned about protecting the integrity of elections, but that cannot be carte blanche to engage in policymaking that has a disproportionately negative impact on some populations without really solving a problem that statistically is existing in the world.
Yeah, and I think that's the way to look at it. You know, what is the nature of the problem, and what is the proportionality of the response? So, looking forward, let's imagine a U.S. 2.0 where we can have a rational discussion about all of this. What sort of reforms could fix the voting problem? I mean, I know there's going to be a lot of resistance on the right to motor voter acts and things like that. But it does seem that we have made voting unreasonably difficult to do. I mean, early voting has changed the dynamics of American politics. Should there be a national holiday? Should there be what sorts of, if you could wave your magic wand, what would you do?
Yeah, well, I think you're starting to see some of it. So one, we should automatically register everyone when they turn 18. So I remember when I turned 18, I had to register. I got a card reminding me that I had to register with the Selective Service. It's certainly possible for us to automatically register people when they turn 18. It shouldn't be a burden on you to go and take a whole bunch of steps well in advance in order to have the right to vote on the day of election day. We should make voting easier in person. That means we should make sure that we have early voting that's readily accessible so that you can go when it's convenient for you. We should have an election day holiday so that those people who work two jobs don't have to worry about whether they're allowed to take off work to go and work. We should make sure that our election administration systems are well run enough that you don't wait online 4 hours to be able to vote. Right. You're starting to see some of this get enacted in states around the country. New York just passed a whole host of voting reforms this week. On the other hand, you're seeing states like obviously your home state of Wisconsin that just restricted early voting in the lame duck session, which I'll just note here, Protect Democracy just filed a lawsuit to challenge that entire lame duck session because, to your earlier point of you worry about the one-way ratchet, we worry that if you start to have a situation in which after elections, the losing party strips power from the incoming party, and that's now happened in North Carolina, Michigan, and Wisconsin, well, two can play at that game. And if both parties start to do that, you really end up in a situation where you don't have a game anymore to begin with. There's a scholar at the University of Michigan, Richard Primus, who we work with on a lot of stuff, who had a tweet once that I loved, and he said it before, which is, democracy is a little bit like schoolyard basketball. If you don't honor the norms and rules of the game and accept it when someone else calls a foul, eventually nobody's going to want to play anymore.
That's actually a good analogy. Well, you know, the what you laid out, all of the reforms, you know, seem to be consistent with, I think, where we're going technologically and culturally in the country, and would expand the scope of democracy. The pushback will come back to this question of, does it make voter fraud? That's why the whole debate about voter fraud becomes so central, because people will say, well, no, if we do this, then it will dramatically enhance the possibility of voter fraud. So the burden of proof, I do think, is going to be, there will be a mixed burden of proof on both sides, you know, show that there's actual real voter fraud, or is it just simply is it vanishingly small? Has it become an urban legend? And we also need to make sure that these systems are not hackable. I mean, this is sort of a side issue. I don't think it's ideological at this point, whether or not, the first time an election is believed to have been hacked by malicious players, then we're in a completely new world, aren't we?
I want to just, for the record here, though, push back on the point that there's any degree of real voter fraud, in-person voter fraud going on in this country. So I'm now on the PolitiFact website where they are fact-checking a statement by Donald Trump where he says there is, quote, substantial evidence of voter fraud, which PolitiFact rates as false. There isn't. There have been numerous studies of this. Chris Kobach was the defendant defendant in a trial in Kansas last year where he was put on the stand and forced to produce all of the evidence of the so-called rampant voter fraud and was unable to do so. There are concerns about the security of our elections, absolutely very real ones. We should all be concerned about the fact that Russia attempted, according to the Department of Homeland Security, to infiltrate 21 states' voter registration databases in 2016 and got into about 16 of them. We have states around the country that still do not have paper trail ballots that could be verifiable after the fact, that don't run
off
of their systems. We actually were in court in South Carolina yesterday in a federal lawsuit we brought on behalf of a lifelong Republican and a lifelong Democrat in South Carolina, because that state has been using voting machines for the last decade that have repeatedly been called out as incredibly vulnerable to interference and intrusion. There is evidence that we have foreign opponents who are trying to infiltrate our systems. Let's focus our energy on that as the threat that there's evidence is real, rather than a threat that is basically an urban myth.
Yeah, that's the – well, it is perhaps possible that Trump's deception on all of this will discredit that argument, that particular narrative. Ian, I wish we had more time. We could continue this. Kind of amazing that we've had this discussion this long, and you being on the left, me being on the right, we have found very few things to disagree about, a lot of things to be worried about at the same time. And I do appreciate you taking time to talk with me today.
I want to end with a note of hope, though, about you being on the right and me being on the left, is we've put together an organization at Protect Democracy that on staff includes people from the right and left. Last week, we hired an alumni of the Weekly Standard and an alumni of Elizabeth Warren's campaign. I think we're probably the only company in the country that can claim to have done that recently. And so the fact that we've got people coming together in an organization, you and I in a coalition, that are committed to reinforcing the norms and institutions of our democratic republic gives me hope that this crisis will be an opportunity. We will be able to reinforce the system for the next generation and pass it on stronger than we found it.
Great to talk with you, Ian. And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.